Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be joined today by John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His latest book is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Now, after hosting and producing the show weekly for 17 years, I stepped aside from recording new live interviews back in 2014. And since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And so podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring our path forward in confronting him and his administration and in finally building the society we need. First off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement forward. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. Indivisibleguide.com, 5,000 local kind of branches all over the country. Indivisibleguide.com, that's really probably number one. OurRevolution.com is the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, that's been around for years, primarily as an online activism site, now coordinates much more closely with on-the-ground grassroots action. FiveCalls.org tells you what the calls are you most need to make any day. TownHallProject.com tells you when your representatives are going to perform town halls or avoid town halls in your constituency, and couragecampaign.org, which is primarily in California, but very active since the election. I say email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more information on this. This is my 15th new show this year, and they're all available at my site, terrencemcnally.net, a world that just might work.com, and great people, Naomi Klein, Chip Berlay on far-right populism, great folks. And John Nichols is somebody that I've been thinking about since I started doing new shows. John Nichols is engaged in the conversation. As I said, as national affairs correspondent for The Nation, he's also associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison. So his beat includes the nation's capital as well as Wisconsin and a lot more. His latest book reports on over 40 players in what Nichols terms the Trumpocalypse. He's on book tour. We've all been a holiday. And yet, not counting the transcripts of his interview on Democracy Now!, I found five of his articles published between August 29th and September 3rd. Now, let me also mention that I had read and interviewed John Nichols for years before I first saw him up in front of a crowd. And that's when I discovered, in addition to the good reporting and the writing, he has a touch of the preacher in him. And I think that passion and that urge to rally folks to something better informs all of his work. At the same time as he reports on the details, John has his eye on the big picture. He's been through a different version of what we're seeing already because he's been covering Scott Walker, who took Wisconsin so far from its progressive roots that voters staged a recall, and then Walker won the recall. So my biggest question that underlies everything today is what needs to happen so that Wisconsin and the rest of the Rust Belt doesn't deliver for Trump again in 2018 and 2020? Nichols co-authored a number of books with Robert McChesney, including The Death and Life of American Journalism and Our Media Not Theirs, The Democratic Struggle Against Corporate Media. He edited Against the Beast, a documentary history of American opposition to empire, and authored several books, including The Genius of Impeachment, one that people will be reaching for now and in the coming months. His latest, as I said, is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Welcome again, John Nichols, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
It's really good to be with you, Terrence. What a good, thorough introduction there. I think that's, you put an awful lot on the table. I like that.
Thank you. Now, you heard the introduction. A couple of things I want to jump off of. First, how widespread is it for a reporter to focus on both the state and national levels to the extent that you do?
I think it's necessary. This is one of the big concerns I have. So much attention is paid to Washington, to the presidency, to the president himself, or hopefully someday herself, that, you know, we have a kind of blurred vision as regards the rest of the country. And so many people in media don't know what's going on out in the rest of the United States. They are superb at commenting on what's happening in Washington. Sometimes we have really good reporters, and I can commend many of them to you. But it's rare that they get far enough beyond the beltway that they can see things coming. Now, I don't claim that I see things coming always. I miss things, and you know, I do my very best. But I'll give you an example of this. In February of 2016, I wrote a cover story for The Nation, and the title was President Trump, It Could Happen. Now, this was in February of that year before he had the Republican nomination. And the way that I recognized something big was happening with Trump was not sitting around in Washington.
That's right.
And in fact, and it also wasn't on the traditional campaign trail where you're just in New Hampshire
following him around,
Iowa,
primary,
which I do plenty of and enjoy. But it was actually talking to friends, acquaintances, elected officials, and union officials in Ohio and Pennsylvania, those two key states. And what I came away with was they, every one of them was saying, all I'm hearing about is Trump. He says, union leaders saying, a lot of my members are talking about Trump. They like Bernie, but I'm hearing too much Trump. These are union leaders who didn't like him, but we're hearing this. I heard it from members of Congress. Give you a good example, Marcy Kaptur, the congresswoman from Toledo, who's been terrific for decades on economic issues. Just a really bold, strong voice. Also a strong anti-war voice over the years, who's done some terrific, courageous stands. And I've known her forever, and I was talking to her, and she said, boy, you know, watch out, this Trump thing, people are listening to him. And so all I'm telling you is that sometimes when you are out of the inner circle where you go to the unexpected places and you talk to a broader range of people, what you find out is something's coming. And now I want to give you one final counsel, though. I didn't, even though I wrote that story, remember the keyword was could.
Yes.
You know, I thought that it, I wanted to explain to people the economic issues and a host of other things that made it possible, as well as the issues of race and xenophobia, which I argued in that were much, much bigger than some people imagined, and much more problematic, that there really were folks out there who were passionately anti-immigrant.
Well, word I was going to say was passion. That race and immigration incite passion, and passion is what gets people to get out and vote.
Well, and it's interesting because I think an awfully lot of progressives, liberals, people of goodwill, wherever their political attitudes lie, you know, immigration is an issue, and they talk about it, they care about it. But when I was covering Trump, and you go to a Trump rally, I mean, it was front and center. It was such a central issue. And again, all I want to say is I didn't necessarily know that Trump was going to become president. That wasn't my sense. But it was clear to me that there was stuff going on out there that was much more incendiary than we imagined. And it was at that point that I started to look at the people around Trump, because I was as interested in them as I was in Trump. It was very clear to me that Donald Trump knew nothing about politics and governance. That didn't make him a bad politician.
Didn't make him a bad candidate.
Right. But he knew nothing about traditional politics, about governance. Some people like that a lot. But he was totally unprepared to govern if he got there. And so that was the genesis of this book, was to start to look at the people who would have the power. Who would govern.
Yeah, who would govern. Let me go back to my first question again. When I asked you how widespread is it for a reporter to cover both state politics and national politics, you said it's essential. Mm-hmm. Still, how often does it happen? Guess is when I look at the LA Times, for instance, Brownstein,
who's very good,
has done both. Meyerson does a little bit of both, but my sense is that it is not nearly as widespread as would be helpful.
Yeah, I think it's necessary.
And my second question, tagging on that, is how did you keep your
feet in both
your places? Feet in both.
Well, this is the interesting thing about it. Some people will say, "Well, that must be hard." Right, to do both. It's not anymore. It may have been at one time, but as we have nationalized our politics and as billionaires like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and people I write about in the book, Robert and Rebecca Mercer, as they begin to really move into our politics as an organized force seeking to affect things from top to bottom, they don't make a distinction. Power doesn't make a distinction between local, state, and national.
Power just says
we want it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I realized a while back Better part of 15 years ago, I started writing about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
15 years ago?
We had a piece in The Nation in 2002.
Wow.
And then, of course, I was involved in the ALEC Exposed Project in 2011, 2012, working with the Center for Media and Democracy and other folks. We had a big feature in The Nation on all that. And but what became clear to me was that the right and its money does not make a lot of distinctions. It just looks at whatever opening is there. For a while there, during the Obama years, the opening was in the states. And so they moved tremendous energy, tremendous amounts of money. That's why Scott Walker won the recall. He had a massive financial advantage in that election. And they really put their energy into the states.
Well, it seems to me, just looking at it from their point of view, which is they're making investment decisions, that you get much more bang for your buck in the states.
You do, and that's true. But remember, these are billionaires of such immense wealth that they don't even always worry about bang for your buck.
They're just looking about bang.
They're looking for the opening, right? And here's what they did in the states, and this is a scary thing that relates very much to the book. They proved in the states that you could go to a far more extreme agenda, and maybe get away with things that people didn't think you could. I'll give you a good example. Assaults on voting rights, right? Obviously, the Supreme Court had a terrible ruling on the Voting Rights Act, and we've seen a lot of deeply problematic, horrifying things coming at the federal level. And yet, where did you see voter ID start rising? Where did you see changes in the rules as regards early voting and when and how you can vote and all these structural things? That started in the states, and now it's bubbled up. I write in the book about Kris Kobach. Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, he's been at this for decades, literally trying to make it much harder for a lot of Americans to vote. Now, having been in the states all this time, having worked with ALEC and all these other power players, now suddenly he's hanging around in Washington with Donald Trump, heading
the commission.
Right.
The commission on election integrity.
Scary stuff. Yeah. And so the point I'm making here is that if you look at the states, if you watch what's happening in the states, you see what's coming to the federal level.
That's my sense. And that's when I prepared to interview with you, that was the thing I thought is actually, you know, you've got the book, you've been doing it, but the thread that makes that's most powerful to me is this thing of the states, because the domination of the state legislatures, domination obviously of the state, call it the gerrymandering, if not, you know, you could call it redistricting, but basically
no, it's
gerrymandering.
Professionalized gerrymandering
now.
All
of that has been going on. And if someone had their eye on that ball instead of being trapped in the Beltway, then as Naomi Klein says, as so many say, Trump is not the cause. He's an effect.
Well, and this is the key thing. The reason that Trump operates in the way that he operates is that he is not politically skilled in every way, but he is a good guy at assessing a property, if you will. And he saw the Republican Party as a property. And he figured out how it operated, how he could jump into it, and how he could take charge of it. And what he realized was a very simple construct. And that was that there was an elite that guided the Republican Party, very wealthy people who wanted tax cuts and trade policies to their benefit. And then there was a mass of Republican voters, socially very conservative, economically hard hit. And all he had to do was wedge himself between them and say, you know, these guys aren't taking care of you. I will. And he played on many of the worst instincts, many of the worst forms of messaging to get himself through that Republican primary process. And why was he able to do that? Well, because many of the things that we found most horrible in Trump's rhetoric were alive at the local level in the Republican Party. They were already there. It's not Donald Trump didn't bring xenophobia or this casual response to Confederates and neo-fascists. He didn't bring that into the game. In many parts of the country and with many members of Congress, It was alive. It was there already. He right. just brought it national.
And if you will, when we keep seeing this congressman says this outrageous thing, this congressman says this outrageous thing, this state legislator says this outrageous thing, those outrageous things hadn't been said maybe since Buchanan's speech in Houston, you know, by a national politician.
Right.
But
right.
Trump was saying things that was already being said on the local and state levels.
And this is the heart of the matter. When you start to examine Donald Trump, look beyond the man. Don't get obsessed with the man. The man's kind of boring. I have to tell you, you know, as best I can tell, he sits around and watches Fox and tweets. That's pretty much, you know, a huge part of the guy. You know, he's a son of privilege who inherited money, which is how you end up doing well in New York real estate, yeah. usually. Not always, but, you know, this is not an exciting.
Got lucky with Mark Burnett, basically.
Yeah, yeah. This is, and then failed. Frequently, economically.
No, I mean got lucky with the TV show.
Right. Oh, yeah. Once he got out of.
Yeah.
Once he got out of one
actually
thing.
Actually trying to do business.
Yeah, yeah. And so with all due respect to Donald Trump, he, from a political standpoint, he's an interesting figure because he cracked open the Republican Party and then used that base to get himself to the presidency, not with a win, by the way. He only got 46% of the vote, but with sufficient to take the Electoral College. So then the question becomes, well, who's going to do this stuff now that he's there?
Yeah.
And who is he going to take counsel from? The counsel that he's gotten, which is incredibly dangerous, in my view, is that he can maintain power, at least maintain control of the Republican Party, if he errs far, far to the right on a host of issues. And that is why, for instance, on education, though I would argue he almost certainly knows better. He made Betsy DeVos the Secretary of Education. She's not up to this job. She's not the right person. She's a billionaire who's been trying to gut out public education. That's why he made Scott Pruitt head of the Environmental Protection Agency. This is a guy who sued the Environmental Protection Agency, who is you know—
Sued it 14 times.
Yeah, and he's a militant climate denialist. Why he put Rick Perry, right, the former governor of Texas— in charge of a cabinet department that Perry wanted to eliminate but couldn't remember.
That's right.
I mean, come on.
No,
if you were doing a movie and you did this, somebody would say to you, Terrence, yeah, you're a good guy. You got a real sense of humor. Yeah, this is over the top.
That you'd put him in charge of the agency he couldn't remember. Come on, that's too cute.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so one of the things that I do in the book is look into these people and ask the question, why do they want this power? Do they want it because they're rigid ideologues, you know, literally bleary-eyed ideologues who will hear no truth beyond what they, quote-unquote, know? I think that's what you get with DeVos and some people like that. Are they self-serving? Do they want power for themselves? There are many hacks who've attached to this thing. But the most dangerous bunch, in my view, are those who essentially represent huge wealth. They may be wealthy themselves. They may have spent a lifetime politically in the service of wealth. But they want to get a hold of these incredibly powerful agencies, of these incredibly powerful structures of government, so that they can enrich their masters. I mean, this is the oldest story in the book. And yet, with Donald Trump, because he is so ill-formed as a man, so ill-formed as a president, he's handed power off to people who will literally do more damage than he would do on his own.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's right. Aside from the chance that his narcissistic paranoia would get us into a nuclear war.
Well, we can never.
That's the one thing where he can do more harm than any of the cabinet people.
We can never rule that out.
And so you put that aside from that.
Well, let me suggest one other thing too. It's often said that the generals that he has brought in are the adults in the room.
Kelly, McMaster, Mattis.
Exactly. And then a lot of other people who've had long-term experience, you know, like one of the second-level people in the Pentagon is somebody who is a defense contractor, right? So it's like this bizarre mix of people who are incredibly self-interested taking charge of these places. And when I say self-interested, I don't take away from Mattis's commitment, you know, or McMaster's or Kelly's. They served this country. They sacrificed for this country. I think they are adults. But that doesn't mean that they're right on issues.
Yes,
and this
yes.
is one of the things.
Being more adult than Trump is a low bar.
No, but the adults that Trump is attracted to have views of how the military should operate with very few strings attached, limited civilian control, a vision of incredibly aggressive interventions, incredibly aggressive war making, if that's what you get to. I would say that fear you have of Trump, you know, that he might be so narcissistic
right.
or that there may be something that would lead us into a terrible place. Yeah, there are points where it might be slowed down by some of these generals. There are also points where, you know, I think especially a non-nuclear setting, but a war setting, where it's accelerated.
And
by
one
these
of
folks.
The things that I think is here also is that during the Bush administration, the State Department, although Condoleezza and you know Colin were big, powerful people, the State Department had lost power to the military.
Mm-hmm.
Under Clinton, there was an attempt to revive the power of the State Department, but right now it has shifted.
Under Obama.
But when she was state.
Oh, yeah, with Clinton. I apologize. Yes, I was thinking.
With her as Secretary of State and him as President. But now we've gone way the other direction again, and Tillerson is weakening state, and we are becoming – and you need state to moderate defense.
You're nailing it. That's exactly right. I'm delighting in this conversation because you're putting the pieces together here in the way that I believe they should be put together. So, of course, we delight in people that agree with us. But there's something that's a big deal about this. First off, when Obama and – when you put Hillary Clinton in charge of the State Department, he was doing a team of rivals thing. This is somebody he had run against for president, and she accepted. And whether you like what they did, whether you agree with the policies that they made, there was a massive reassertion of an alternative pole to the Pentagon. And in fact, I would argue that at some points during the Obama years, under not just Clinton, but Kerry, was more central in many ways to discussions than, you know, not the Pentagon always, but at least the military-industrial complex is a little dialed down. And this is not to distract from or deny the fact that we were still in wars.
That's right.
We still had...
Went into Libya, messed up in Yemen.
Horrible
blah,
stuff.
Blah, blah.
And also drones and all sorts
yes.
of other issues.
And
so
assassination.
We don't miss a bit of that.
Right.
But yet state was present and thus, in some cases... human rights concerns are dialed up. In some cases, diplomacy, way dialed up, and I think especially on Iran. In some cases, aid dialed up in ways that really mattered. Now, many people have asked me why when I group all these people, I group Tillerson in with the generals. The answer to the question is that if we think of a military-industrial complex in the sense that Dwight Eisenhower did, which is a tremendous amount of power built up around the military and around those who want the military to be big and powerful so they can make money, that it needs counterbalances. It needs the counterbalance of citizen engagement, people like Barbara Lee, citizen engagement, their representatives, people like Barbara Lee and others stepping up and saying, hold it. Ted Lieu, congressman from California, new congressman, saying, hold it. You got to have an authorization to do this. I mean, that's an important part of the balance. But also state is an important part of the balance. And the fact of the matter is Rex Tillerson is systematically dismantling and dialing down the Department of State. When I was working on this book, I talked to a lot of people who are in and around the State Department, some retirees, retired ambassadors. I have to tell you, it was a universal complaint. They were literally saying, this guy is bringing in management teams to see how to do less with less. You know, he's accepting the cuts to state.
Yeah, and purposely not filling positions.
Tons of positions. And also whole sections, areas that were on the cutting edge. And so I write a lot about this because if you don't have a State Department filling that void and being there, at least something that you got to wrestle with, even in a Trump administration, that makes...
the vacuum...
yeah, it fills it with, again, exactly what Eisenhower filled, And there's one final component of this that I'll put in the mix. In addition to putting Tillerson in with the generals, I also put Mick Mulvaney, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, there.
In with the generals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Mulvaney is a passionate advocate for austerity at home. He wants to cut programs at home. I write in the book about how he's a big critic of Meals on Wheels. Who would ever gripe about Meals on Wheels?
Really.
You know, come on. I've actually gone out as a kid, you know, and did the deliveries. Boy, I just want to testify. Meals on Wheels is something people love, and it does a lot of good. But he's saying, oh, we don't have to, you know, we could take money from there. Where does he want to put all the money? Pentagon.
Wow.
Massive, tens of billions in the budget proposal, moving away from state, away from domestic programs, over to the Pentagon. This is exactly what Eisenhower warned about. And Eisenhower's kind of a hero of the book, weirdly enough.
Yeah, sure.
What he warned about, not just in the military-industrial speech, but in another incredible speech he gave in 1953, just weeks after becoming president. It's called the Cross of Iron speech.
Oh, yeah.
A beautiful speech in which he said, as a general, and just coming out of the Korean War, said, you know, every aircraft carrier we build, that's schools or roads we don't build at home. He says there is a push and pull here. And if we bend too far toward militarism, we end up with a diminished homeland. Eisenhower laid that out, you know, now the better part of seven decades ago. And the only reason I bring it up here is to say I think that things that people were warning us about in the distant past are now coming to reality here under Donald Trump. And we ought to be talking about it, but you can't have the right conversation if you begin and end with Donald Trump.
Right.
That's why you have to look at all these other players and all that's going on.
So where I said he's not the cause, he's an effect of things that have been bubbling up, you're mm-hmm. saying yes, and mm-hmm. Because of his particular or his almost unique inability and ignorance, mm-hmm. The people around him have more power than, I mean, I think of like Nixon having a meese,
yeah,
you know, who seemed like someone you'd get to break the agency, you know.
Or Reagan with meese.
Reagan with meese.
Yes.
But Mitchell.
Nixon, I'll give you another example of Nixon. And I write, because the book is steeped in history.
Yeah, of course.
And there's a lot of players who pass through all these places. But I'll give you a very good example. When Nixon came in, he inherited the war on poverty. He put Rumsfeld in charge of a key agency that was really very central to war on poverty stuff. Cheney ended up over there.
That's right.
So you had Rumsfeld and Cheney not doing their international stuff. They were on domestic policy duty at that point, and they were dialing it down, weakening it. Today we have Paul Ryan and other people running around saying, oh, the war on poverty didn't work. The war on poverty worked. It's just that then people came in and starved it.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to know who's moving these levers and why they're moving them.
Yeah, the point I was making was that even though Nixon appointed some people who you'd say, well, that seems like absolutely the wrong person for that department, as you said, he was still in charge. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nixon was a player.
He was hands-on.
Yeah. And this is absolutely the opposite. Let me shift this just a little bit. Take another step backwards. So the question that I ended my intro with, which is what needs to happen so that Wisconsin and the rest of the Rust Belt, your mm-hmm. home turf, you started your journalistic career in Toledo, Ohio.
I did.
And
yeah.
you are now in Madison, Wisconsin. These are two of the states that turned this election.
Sure.
So that they don't continue to deliver for Trump, as I said, in 2018, in 2020. So I want that to be kind of the background question and for us to get to, because I know that although you're a reporter doing investigative pieces, you're also a passionate advocate.
Oh, I have passion, and Tom Paine, I hope.
So I want our last section to be on,
sure.
you know, ultimately, how do we make sure that both the resistance groups and the Democratic Party and so on operate so that we come out of this in 2018 with as much gains as possible. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you your take again on what happened and what you think needs to happen to change the outcomes in a couple of fields. Now, you've written a great deal about the media.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the trends in the media that elected Trump and re-delivered Congress to this and the states to the GOP, and what do we need to do about that? And then I'll ask you a couple more.
Of course, and I think that's a vital question. You know, obviously, Bob McChesney and I have written books for many, many years about media, and predicted a lot of the stuff that was happening, not because, you know, we had some crystal ball, but because if you study economics, if you study the basic structures of this stuff, you know where it's going. And also because we were students of Ben Bagdikian, not students in class per se, but students of his wisdom and friends. And Bagdikian laid this out in the 1980s. Essentially, he said, you know, as you start to conglomerate control of the media into a few hands, it's going to go logically toward the lowest common denominator, that which people all know about. And so instead of covering the states, instead of covering Congress well, instead of covering cabinet agencies, we cover Donald Trump. If you've got a new tweet out, that becomes central. And Trump recognized that that change had come full. And so he exploited it. He exploited the fact that you could use social media to become dominant in traditional media. Interesting thing. Send a tweet, they spend the whole day talking about it. Hold a rally, they cover it wall to wall. He recognized that if you were an entertainment figure stepping into the political sphere, that you could achieve things that could not have been achieved in the past because of the changes in how media operates.
Right.
Rise of social media, decline of reporting, decline of commitment to deep coverage, closing of Washington bureaus so that now you just have this national operation. That is unfortunately a signal of where our politics is going, because the fact of the matter is Trump has appointed people, like the head of the FCC, who I write a lot about in the book, has appointed people that are kind of on that team.
They're taking it further.
Well, yes. And in fact, they're talking about attacking net neutrality. Now, understand this. You and I will criticize television now and again. Television would say it doesn't do a very good job of covering stuff.
Right, right. We might say it's the golden age of narrative television. But not of informative
not of news.
Right.
And that it may have even become what Newton Minow predicted, a vast wasteland. Well, remember, at one time, that platform of television was viewed as something that could be incredibly educational, could really get us to another place. And frankly, the early newsrooms and mid-period newsrooms, they tried to mimic the best of what newspapers did,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
No more.
Now, by the way, the book I would go to even more than that, and I'm sure you would too, is Neil Postman's
of course.
Amusing Ourselves to Death. If anything describes the campaign of Donald Trump, it's Amusing Ourselves
totally,
to Death.
Totally, totally. And so this is where it gets interesting, though. Each time you have a platform, there's a dream of what it could be. Radio, the dream of what it could be, educational and all this. Television, a place for really discourse and real investigative reporting, all sorts of stuff like that. We get new platforms. It's dissipated. Why is it dissipated? Because as a country, we allow power to step in and replace civic and democratic values with commercial and entertainment values. Now, the question is, what will the internet be? And if we lose net neutrality, the internet will be another platform conquered by commercial entertainment values at the expense of civic and democratic values. Net neutrality being, and we're not going to go into the deep zone of it, but I talk a lot about it in the book because, of course, net neutrality is the First Amendment of the internet. It says everything's treated equally. You gut that out and you allow people to buy a faster route to folks.
Yeah, that when more money means more speed on the internet, that changes what the internet has been and still is.
Right. And so we are right now, you say, well, what do we have to do? Perfect question. We are right now in the thick of battles over what the future of media will be. If we lose net neutrality, we are going to be in a much worse position. If what the FCC is looking at doing with allowing cross-ownership, exactly.
How about Sinclair Broadcasting?
Waiver. Yeah, Sinclair Broadcasting, right wing.
Anybody
operation.
Who hasn't followed that one, Sinclair Broadcasting owns more stations around the country.
Local stations, yeah.
Local stations than anyone, and they are now attempting to expand that and to have some rules changed in the FCC so that they can come into LA and they can come into Chicago and they can have more cross-ownership than they have. And they air right-wing stuff in their news where people know Fox News is Fox News. People at home watching their local channel. I mean, I forget which stations it would be in LA, but it's stations that local folks trust. Once Sinclair takes those over, they will now be infiltrated by that, and they won't know it's Fox on a local level.
And local news is watched more closely than any other news, especially the evening news.
That's
you want
right.
to know the weather the next
You're
day.
Right.
You do all this stuff. It's just reality. And so there's another thing that they're talking about, which is giving waivers so that you can produce a newscast for one local station, and it can then become the newscast for other local stations. So you have one newsroom producing all the news, right? Maybe with a different anchor, but the basics, the guts of it. This is consolidation of the media on warp speed. And so first off, to go to your core question, we have to stop this. We have to fight this. And you can't do this just by looking at Trump. You've got to look at what the FCC is doing. Groups like Free Press and Common Cause, a host of other groups, all sorts of civil rights groups are focused there. Follow what they're doing. Pay attention to what they're doing, because it's a big deal.
Then on both those issues.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because both of them, it isn't just – both of them will call for to get away from net neutrality and to allow Sinclair Broadcast and do what it wants to do. Both will necessitate.
It'll move the needle to the right,
but it'll necessitate rule changes.
Absolutely, and
so
they can be
fought. Isn't just that these things will inevitably happen, but they are likely to happen unless there is huge citizen action.
And let me give you another example. There's been, and this is one that people never talk about. There's been an assault on the post office for years. Trying to privatize, trying to, you know, gut it out. Post office actually is something, it's mentioned, literally Postal Service mentioned in the Constitution.
I know.
And that assault.
I mean, free speech and the post office are
go together
linked.
Because it allows us to communicate with lots of people via a relatively low-cost alternative means.
That's why the Founding Fathers set it up.
Absolutely.
To promote free speech and democracy.
So let's defend what we've got. But then to go that next step, let us start to understand that we have to develop a better understanding of social media, a better understanding of new media, and how to use it. Now, you're doing it. I'll tell you, you're going to ask that question looking for some sort of magic potion here. Well, the magic potion is what you listed at the start of this interview, where you went through the websites you've got, the podcasts you're doing, all this structural stuff. Last week I was on Amy Goodman's show on Democracy Now!, I mean, that's an amazing thing that has happened there. And sometimes, you know, we take it for granted, but you got to step back and recognize that Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, and their crew have created something that is national, that is influential, that works on multiple platforms.
So it's available anytime, anywhere.
Right, but also on broadcast in a lot of places.
Right.
And that's done not with big corporate money, but supported at the grassroots. Just a final element of it. People were amazed when Bernie Sanders ran for president of the United States that he was able to fund a campaign for president with $27 contributions, massive numbers of $27 contributions. I'd like to see full campaign finance reform, but at least that's a better model than corporate money. And I have to tell you, I'd like to see supercharged public broadcasting and supercharged not-for-profit broadcasting. But in the meantime, that model of the $27 contribution supporting the media that we want and need becomes more vital than ever. We need to take that concept, look at the amount of money that Sanders raised for a presidential campaign, and say, what if we raised that kind of money on a regular basis for independent, not-for-profit media using all of the platforms that are now available, broadcast, digital? We can create alternatives. They are not the final fix for all the problems we have. But if we allow the FCC to gut out net neutrality, to allow for further consolidation, our chances of creating those alternatives are lessened. So that's the core of the fight today.
And the power of those alternatives, even if created, becomes less.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. So let me just tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His latest book is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. You can learn more at thenation.com, and you can follow John on Twitter at Nichols Uprising. And Nichols is N-I-C-H-O-L-S Uprising, at Nichols Uprising. Okay, let me go to another one, trends that you've been watching and writing about. Voting rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did that come into play in 2016, and what do we have to do before 2018?
Okay. Came to play a long time before 16, as you well know.
But how did it play in that? Yeah.
Okay. I expand the definition of voting rights or try to. First off, we have to be deeply concerned about voter ID laws and limits on early voting, things like that. These structural changes matter. We have to push back against what the Supreme Court has done. Interestingly enough, there are even Republicans who agree with me. Very conservative Republican Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin is in alliance with John Conyers to restore elements of the Voting Rights Act. There are people who actually believe that elections should be real and right. work, and everybody should be in.
Must be an old guy.
Yeah, he is. trust, unfortunately, but there aren't enough like him. But all I'm telling you is, we have to focus first and foremost on those core issues. But let us expand the definition to recognize that the people who made Donald Trump possible, and the people who now want to extend what has happened, they've got a couple areas where they're working very, very hard. They want to nationalize the state-based restrictions on voting. And so you see Chris Kobach and Vice President Pence and others with this commission really working on that. What they're trying to nationalize is something that gave them an advantage.
Yeah.
As Ari Berman and others have written, the number of people who were disenfranchised by voter ID laws in some of these key states, like Wisconsin, more than makes up for the difference between Clinton's total in November and Trump's total
right.
in November.
Berman says, and folks, I did interview Ari Berman for an hour a few weeks ago, and you can find that one on my site.
It's very important stuff.
TerrenceMcNally.net or a world that just might work.com. 200,000 mm-hmm. is what he figures were kept
yeah.
from voting in Wisconsin, and the ultimate difference was
22. It was 22,000, but you would only need to switch
That's right.
about 11,000.
That's right.
And in Michigan, it's even smaller. But here's where it gets interesting. In addition to that, so we focus on that first step, but let us also focus on the dismantling of the democratic infrastructure, small d democratic infrastructure of this country. Wisconsin went from being a strong pro-union state to a right-to-work state, quote-unquote right-to-work, anti-union. So did Michigan. So did Indiana during the period of Obama's presidency. Obama in 2008 carried those three states with relative ease. Indiana closer, of course. What changed? Well, we weakened our unions. We made it harder to vote. We made infrastructure, structural changes. And that, I would argue, that combination of factors tips the balance politically. In big states, states like Michigan, states like Ohio, and so that's an answer as regards 2016. As we go to 2018, here's the amazingly encouraging news. There's a huge challenge to gerrymandering that has made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's aimed at, you know, some of the moderate judge like Kennedy, and it's very sophisticated. It's a very sophisticated argument. It's gotten through all the lower level courts and is now at the Supreme Court. There is a chance, not a certainty, that we could see gerrymandering upended. If that happens, we can change a lot fast. Secondly, people are becoming more sophisticated about how to respond to assaults on voting rights, to assaults on, you know, early voting and things like that. Lawsuit. There's groups like Brennan Center and others who have really gotten into this and done good work. And so as we look toward 2018, I think the important thing to understand is it's going to be different than most off-year elections. It's not going to
yes,
be.
It is.
It's not going to be traditional.
Well, but wait, this it might be akin to 2010 mm-hmm. was
yes.
for the right.
Yeah, and that's because
there it was the election of a black suddenly galvanized people, and here it's the election of Trump and mm-hmm. this cabinet that you write about.
Different elements there, and here's what
so
I would
not a normal off-term election.
Well, maybe a normal one in the sense that we have started to have counter-cyclical politics. 2006, huge rejection of Bush. 2010, big rejection of Obama. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's possible that we could see this what is actually now a developing pattern where people are so dissatisfied with Washington that they ricochet. But critical to that, and this is the guts of it, and it's where Indivisible and other groups have to be very conscious as they move forward, and all the Our Revolution, all these groups that you mentioned up front, they have got to be focused on making sure that if we have a surge of young people, if we have a surge of people of color, if we have a surge of lower income voters in rural and urban areas saying, you know, boy, we're ready to vote. We're sick of this. We want to make this change. We're terrified of what Trump's appointees and what his administration is doing, even if he's a dysfunctional mess. We're terrified of the whole of this thing. We're going to come vote. it becomes absolutely vital to make sure that those barriers are struck down where possible. And if the barriers are there, then instead of pouring billions of dollars into television ads, how about you pour billions of dollars, or at least hundreds of millions, into helping people leap the barriers, letting people who are qualified to vote, who want to vote, have an easy time of voting. And the demand we should make is the simplest one. Look at what Oregon has done in making voting easy. Voting can be easy everywhere in the United States.
Can that happen in time?
Some states it can. Illinois just
That's right.
struck down a lot of barriers. I mean, really made it quite a bit easier. First step is to, where we live, make it easier to vote if it's possible. California is a very good example. You know, you work where you can, but then you also, please, 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 I just did a big piece in The Nation on rural policy and rural issues. Don't abandon those folks who live in rural America. Don't abandon those folks who live in southern states. Don't abandon those folks who live in states that voted for Trump. You may not win those states, but if you can get the barriers down, if you can get voters to the polls, even in states that you might find unexpected places, you can swing congressional seats. You can also swing legislative seats. And here's a heart and soul issue. 2018 is one of the two critical elections, 2018, 2020, for deciding how we redistrict.
Yes, because the redistricting happens a decade following the census. The most critical ones for Democrats or progressives are the 2010s and so on that are not also presidential elections.
And
but
gubernatorial
as you're saying,
races as well.
There are people getting elected in 2018 that will still be in power.
Mm-hmm. Especially governors.
Yeah. So you get that. So you the folks elected in states in 2018 and 2020 will be the ones deciding on congressional districts and state legislative districts following the census in 2020. And let's not even talk about the fact that they haven't funded the census
or done anything to prepare for it. You could write books about that.
That's right. And somebody will. They are going into a census in a country of 350 million people, and they are not prepared.
And under-surveying key groups, it looks like, or potential of it. And again, final thing I'd say on this, keep track of Kris Kobach. Look at what he is doing. If he comes down with universal standards and says these should be enacted by the states— be at the ready immediately to push back. This is, again, I hate to be like a broken record, but this is, again, why, you know, don't just look at Trump's tweet. Don't just look at Trump's horrific press conferences and these things like that. Look at what the people he has empowered are proposing and be at the ready to resist fully, right? I mean, resistance is it's a wonderful word. In France, it's, you know, at rallies they chant resistance, you know, and I love it. I love the concept of it. But ours must be a universalized resistance, not merely a resistance to one man,
yes,
but a resistance to a whole that is threatening.
And as Naomi Klein's book, No Is Not Enough, resistance is what may push you out the door or push you to your, but it has to go beyond that. You have to take, as the Tea Party did, you have to take this feeling and turn it into a positive. What I say is, it's like you pull a rubber band back. It bounces further than you held it back.
That's exactly right.
You want this not only to resist, but to overtake.
Yes.
To use this worst moment as the moment when never again, not you know, that what comes out of this when we look back in 2022, 2024 is movement way beyond where we were, because as you and I know, if Hillary Clinton would have been elected, we'd be having a conversation still about the lack of universality of opportunity and so on. Do you know what I'm saying? Is that the situation was not nirvana, and it will not be merely by getting rid of Trump and winning Congress.
The great battle of our time is against neoliberalism.
Absolutely.
And against militarism. You combine these two. With, of course, at the root of both those and tied to both those, a concern about the planet. We're not confused about what we're fighting on here.
And when you say just for anyone, I mean, probably most people, when you say the big battles against neoliberalism, your two sentence, three sentence, four sentence.
Well,
thing,
it's
what that
basically
means.
The Trump budget.
But,
look, neoliberalism.
It's austerity.
It
in
is
every
austerity.
Form.
And Barack Obama was certainly not a perfect president in every way. And I was very critical of him on many issues.
As was I.
And yet, at the same time, this is a very interesting thing. If you read magazines like The Economist, they say that the stimulus that Obama did, which I thought was too small, in right after the election, 2009, is that stimulus, putting money into the economy, allowed the United States to do better than the countries that did in Europe, especially austerity, where they tried to squeeze everything so they could balance budgets. And one of the things that I really want to emphasize is that we now are coasting on the basis of that. Trump is proposing a squeeze. The Trump budget, and which Mulvaney and these other people talk about, and it's really, this is a central thing in the book, is where they want to go is toward an austerity at home, which is neoliberalism on steroids, movement of money to the Pentagon. And if they get away with this, there will be tremendous suffering. Many people struggle, some people struggle to pronounce the word Trumpocalypse. Many people assume Trumpocalypse refers to a nuclear war. I understand that fear, but my fear and my understanding of a Trumpocalypse is that the worst policies of neoliberalism are brought to bear on the average American, where people pay relatively high taxes but get virtually no services, where our resources go to the powerful and wealthy, where we redistribute wealth upwards to people like Donald Trump rather than having a fair and functional society. That's the struggle we're in, and it's not the only struggle.
Because as you say, militarism, war, and climate change.
Yeah.
Those are existential crises. Mm-hmm. But this crisis of continuing to squeeze the normal citizen, the mm-hmm. average citizen, to make the wealthy wealthier is a slower fuse existential crisis.
And it also draws us away from dealing with issues of militarism,
right.
away from dealing with issues of the planet, particularly environmental racism.
Right. And the other thing that neoliberalism does, and it must be by design, is that when people see that government serves the wealthy and not them, people become cynical, people become resigned. So even if they don't go to the Tea Party and don't go to Trump rallies, they are less likely to care or to vote.
That's exactly right. And I've noted during this conversation that you've not even brought up Steve Bannon. And that's fine. I happen to think Bannon's still very, very powerful. I write a lot about him. But
By the way, your thought, as you wrote in something I read, you said, this may have been his idea. He's a master strategist. He's probably the brightest guy in the administration. And my thought is, when he gets out of that unwieldy apparatus and back to Breitbart,
he's pressuring this administration to go even further to the
right.
That's
right.
So, and I think we have to understand this. But one of the things that he said, which I think he was very honest about, he said, the goal is deconstruction of the regulatory state. And so I really counsel, if you are concerned about austerity, if you're concerned about neoliberalism, if you are concerned about economic inequality, then you have to look at the people Trump has put into key positions. At HHS, he's got Tom Price overlooking our healthcare. This is a guy who is a visceral critic of any concept of healthcare for all, of single payer, anything like that. But beyond that, he wants to deconstruct what we already have. Putting Ben Carson at HUD, Housing and Urban Development, this is a terrible thing. And putting Betsy DeVos in charge of education, I just want to emphasize, this is where the redistribution of the wealth upwards will occur. It's through these agencies. It's also through the SEC, where you've got you have people over at the Securities and Exchange Commission who used to be lawyers for the people they regulate.
Yep.
You've got people at the FCC who used to be lawyers for the people they regulate. The lobbyists for power no longer have to lobby from the outside because Donald Trump has put them on the inside.
Yeah, that's what the book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, will bring you. As I said, it's a field guide to the privateers, the financiers, the militarists within that he has appointed. And as John has said a couple of times, this is more important in this administration than even in others because he's a tweeter in chief. He's a rallier in chief. The real work is being done by the folks you're talking about. We've got, 5 minutes, four. I want you to take three of them to tell me what we do about the Democratic Party.
Sure.
If we were in any other business and they had lost state legislatures over and over again while the people basically agree with their policies. And then they lose presidential elections because they can't play the Electoral College. And so even though they win by 3 million, they lose. What do we do about them?
Well, it's a vital question, and it relates to everything we're talking about here, because at the end of the day, politics is competition for power. And Donald Trump got the power. What he's doing with this power is terrifying. It ought to help us to understand that the debates about the future of the Democratic Party are not about, you know, this fiefdom or that fiefdom or this person or that person, because I've seen it become very personalized. No, these debates are about whether you have an alternative poll to a militant right-wing presidency and administration that is moving this country backwards, in some cases to the 1950s, in some cases to the 1850s. Terrible, frightening stuff. And so what is the alternative to that? Is the alternative to, frankly, cruel and unusual politics that is often very crude, very intellectually empty? Is the alternative to that to give you more of the same, right? No. The alternative to that, which energizes Americans, is a smart politics. And my argument for the Democratic Party is it has to become a smart party. Don't be a party that simply, you know, tries to mimic Trump's populism. I don't mind progressive populism. I quite like it. But
your state,
it has some history with LaFollette.
It has some history with it, yeah.
But become a party that offers a progressive populism, but also a party that explains our circumstance. It offends and stuns me that we went through the 2016 campaign without a serious discussion of the fact that we are 30 years into a globalization regime that's changing everything about how we relate to the world. We're 20 years into a digital revolution that's changing everything about how we communicate. We're 10 years into an automation revolution that's going to change everything about how we work and, you know, how our lives
are
organized.
And how we support ourselves.
And we didn't have a debate about that. Now, I don't expect Donald Trump to give us a debate about that. His answer to that is, again, we're going to go back to something that can never be recreated.
Right.
The answer that the Democratic Party has to be is next. What are you going toward? And the answer to that is, I'll be very blunt, you have to have a social democracy. You have to have guarantees of health care and transportation and education, much like our European friends do, if you're going to fill the void that is created in our employment by automation and all of these other changes. And you know what? If you talk about that in a blunt, real way, there's a lot of people that suddenly say, well, that sounds smarter than again.
I know. And the other thing, and I'm just going to throw this because we don't have time to deal with it, is you got to tell a better story. You have to. In other words, what I say is we need a story that is more exciting than the yearning for the past.
Yeah.
We just need a story about a future that pictures an America that is more exciting than the past.
Give me 10 seconds here, brother. 100 years ago, right? The literature was 150 years ago even. Literature was utopian fiction. It looked to the future and said, it can be good if we do these things. The Democratic Party desperately needs to produce a vision of the future and say it can be good if we go this way. If it fails to do that, if it just plays Trump's game, we're in a very dangerous space.
Okay, we got to close there. So again, you can learn more at thenation.com. You can follow John on Twitter at Nichols Uprising, NICHOLS Uprising, one word. His newest book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. I knew if I said it often enough during the show, it would get easy.
You nailed it.
Thank you, John Nichols, and keep up the good work.
Solidarity.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. And there you'll find years. Listen anytime, anywhere. Include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.